This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I wanted to tell you that this presentation is going to be in two parts. The first part is going to be about the creative process whereby artwork for a pin game is arrived at, which sometimes is simple and sometimes is very complex. And toward the end of the talk, I'm going to display some of the concepts I did early on in my career that never got made into games, but you can judge for yourself whether they would have been cool. I'm going to start out with the original drawing, which became Barracora. It didn't start out as Barracora. I designed this to be Barracuda, which seems to fit the theme of the fish heads growing out of the face. I did this for Williams at a time when I was working for advertising posters, when we had found out through the secret pipeline that the people at Williams, Mike Stroll, the president in particular, was less than excited about the kind of artwork that Constantino Mitchell was doing. And we had an inroad that we were going to show them an idea that maybe they'd like to come back to the ad posters art department and use us like they had for many years in the past. My task assigned to me was come up with an image so compelling, so interesting and imaginative and well executed that they couldn't resist using an ad posters artist again. That's where I came up with this. I presented this to Mike Stroll in the office with a bunch of top designers, and the first reaction from Mike was, "I love it, but I don't like the title. I think it has some negative connotations." Keep in mind that this was shortly after the success of the Jaws movies, where people get eaten. It's kind of why I wanted to do this idea. So while they decided on the spot to start kicking around other names for this, I went into a panic, and I went, don't call it something stupid. And I said, well, how about it's a proper name? It's her name. She is Barracora. And Mike Stroll went, yeah, Barracora. Thus, Barracora got made. So that's the story behind this. And this drawing is in my booth over at the expo, if for anyone who'd like to see it. Number two. There, blow that puppy up. The process of development. Steve Ritchie and I had done F-14 Tomcat together, and he was ready to do his follow-up game, which was going to be a sequel to his classic hit, Black Knight. The artist Tony Ramuni had done a nice job of packaging Black Knight with a knight on a horseback, and I decided he wanted to call the game Black Knight 2000. And I went, well, okay, that's sort of a futuristic kind of name to call the game as a sequel. Let's do something a little stranger. Let's do something a little more imaginative. So my idea was to put a flying knight on a flying dinosaur with his armored everything, and just the first pass on some kind of city that flying people would live on and go to. And I submitted this concept to Steve. And Steve went, no. And then we went back and forth for a while, like a number of days, where I tried to sell him on the idea of doing either something fantasy, something science fiction, something heroic, something different. And his patience with me got shorter and shorter and shorter until finally we were kind of like doing this together. And he said, Doug, all I want is a black knight in black armor on a black horse with lightning bolts. You know, in his frustration, that's how he summed it up. And if you have seen Black Knight 2000, what you get is a black knight in black armor on a black horse with lightning bolts. So I fell back not on illustration, but on pure graphic design. And to this day, Steve still thinks it's one of the handsomest packages anyone ever did for him. There was one of my first passes. Once he decided, okay, here's your black knight on a black horse, but it didn't have the lightning bolts yet. So, okay, shelved this concept and went right onto the one that finally got made into the game, which looks like that. All right. One of my favorite big movie license projects. When you're dealing with a big movie license, you don't go with the very first eye that pops into your head. I was fortunate enough when I worked on this, as opposed to working on Terminator 2, Working on Terminator 2 was a real test of imagination because James Cameron, when he makes a production, reveals nothing about what he's doing. Even though we had purchased the license to do Terminator 2, the movie was still being shot at the time when I was doing the game. I hadn't seen the movie. I hadn't seen any part of it. Absolutely nothing. So trying to do an entire pin game for a movie that you've never seen was a tough order. For Indiana Jones, completely the opposite. All three movies at that time were already released, so I had free rein to just choose what to do with that game. So my very first sketch for Indiana Jones was Harrison with the Ark of the Covenant behind him, which I assume would be a major objective in the game. And that's just how the sketch turned out. And moving on, the next version after that is that I began to kick around the idea that, well, maybe with a wide body like that, we would have enough room in the game to go after more movie-based objectives. So I managed to start squeezing in the Holy Grail and the Shankara Stone and even the Cross of Coronado. Well, that's four objects for three movies. And I came up with this sort of like dynamic pose for Indy with his whip cracking, and we're finally starting to arrive at something that more along the line of what I'm thinking of for the whole project. So this one has more little details like submarines and tanks and rope bridges and flying aircraft. I'm trying to figure out what are the iconic images that an audience is going to associate with that license that's so huge. How can I encapsulate that down into something that just says it all in one look? That's another version where I'm capitalizing on movie star power and just tried to fit the whole cast in there along with Harrison Ford and did a little touch of color as I began to experiment, like, what is my color palette going to be like? Is it going to be like real bright, saturated colors? Is it going to be typical pinball art color? I don't know. And finally, I came up with this design. I was influenced by the two fantastic movie poster illustrators that they used for these pictures. Everyone's familiar with the work of an artist named Drew Struzan, the most famous pinball poster illustrator ever, who did all of the Indiana Jones and all the George Lucas movies, like Back to the Future. He illustrated all those. So I studied his work, but what I really decided is that the most signature image for Indy came from the artist who did Raiders of the Lost Ark. That was a top illustrator from the 70s named Richard Amzel, who did a colored pencil drawing on Masonite, which became Raiders of the Lost Ark poster. So I went back to Richard Amzel's Indy, and I used sort of Drew Struzan's idea for architectural elements, and that was the final layout I arrived at. And this is me trying to decide, okay, how about these muted desert earth tone colors? That's sort of what you associate with Indiana Jones. Lots of bright yellows and you know, as opposed to a more typical pinball palette. So that's how that finally came to be. Indiana Jones is that creative process I went through. And there it is. So this gives you an idea of how does an illustrator working in this industry get from point A, you now have a project to do an Indiana Jones game, to this. It's a process. And it's a lot of questioning your decisions. It's a lot of like, well, maybe, and how about, and what's the downside? And you just do a lot of thinking that goes into the work. All right. This was the most challenging project I ever had to deal with a movie license. It made me Wesley Snipes' eternal enemy, because Dennis Nordman came to me and said, Doug, I want to do a licensed game with you. I think they're the artist to do a licensed game with, that I've got a license arranged. He says, I want to do Demolition Man. I said, okay, Dennis, we were good friends. I read the script and I went, why do you want to do this? This is stupid. You know, I didn't like the script. I didn't want to do the game. And he says, well, Doug, you know, it's got Stallone in it, and it's going to have big special effects, and I just want to do it. I went, okay, I'll do my best shot. And I started thinking about what is it about Sylvester Stallone that I can exploit that's cool in artwork. He has this great chiseled face, and he has this famous physique. So I went, okay, does he take his clothes off in the movie? Yeah, he does. So I'm going to display some of that famous Stallone physique. This was my first initial sketch based on the information I had gotten from the production company, which is always very limited. And Wesley Snipes played a character, Simon Phoenix, who is a futuristic, over-the-top psychopath with the blonde hair and one blue eye, and he's just supposed to be a crazy man. So I had a photo of his character looking like that. And I went, okay, well, that's who he is in the movie, is Crazy Wesley. And then, you know, solid, heroic Stallone and some other characters. So I sent this off to the production studio for approval. And it came back rejected. But no explanation for why. So I went, okay, I'll try again. So this is me trying to draw people a little bit more carefully, just in case they didn't like the way they were executed. And this led to a more complete design like that. I sent that off. And the response is rejected. No explanation. Now I'm doing this while the movie's being shot. So the actors are on set and they're working. And everyone whose face I'm illustrating has an agent who's going to sign off on whether that's going to meet with their approval. So the more faces of actors you put in the back glass, the bigger challenge it can become for an illustrator. I start simplifying into just the three big major stars. I get to this point, rejected. Well, at this point, my time is running out. I work on a scheduled deadline. I've got to get this game done. And we kind of need to get backlash approval before you start the rest of the game package, because it all keys off the elements you put into a backlash design. Well, this is weeks and weeks going by. And I'm finally getting like, what's the problem? And I used whatever resources I had from Chicago to try to find out what was the issue going on with these rejections without any explanation. I'm not being art directed. I'm just being rejected. So this is with more sizzle and more excitement, more explosions going off, and a different pose for Stallone to try to look even more handsome. This is what the problem turned out to be. In 1993, when this movie came out, Wesley Snipes was a young, rising star, very physical, who had dreams of being a leading man actor. In this role, he played the bad guy. But in his judgment, he only wanted to be portrayed as handsome and sexy. So after I waste a good 2 months banging out these sketches, being rejected, this is literally isn't all the ones I did. I did 11 of these tight sketches before I found out that Wesley's personal agenda was I need to look handsome and sexy. And he insisted that I need my head and my face to be just as big as Mr. Stallone's head. I'm not playing second fiddle to that guy. So I'm going, okay, you need to look handsome and sexy. I have no photos of you looking handsome and sexy. I got to go somewhere and find something that looks remotely like that from some previous film he did. And then I got to make his head the same size. Well, that's a real compromise in terms of composition. So there he is with his head mathematically the same size as Stallone's. And to make the composition have any balance at all, I had to blow up Sandra Bullock's visage as well. I think this is a really ugly, clumsy layout for a pinball back glass. I'm not proud of it, but I was art directed by someone who was an idiot. In fact, they wasted so much of my time on this, because I launched in this project hoping I'd get to paint Sylvester Stallone's portrait dramatically lit. That was my only incentive. He has this great, craggy, chiseled face, and I knew I could do a fantastic-looking portrait. I get to this stage, and my scheduled time is gone to do the backlash. I have to start the playfield now. So I handed this off to fellow artist at Williams, Linda Deal, who proceeded to make the painting instead of me. So I'm the person who went through all the agony and the effort to come up with this, and yet some other artist got to do the painting. Thank you. Welcome to Hollywood. All right. Williams, was it Williams? Yes. Bally's Pool Sharks. This is what I started out with. Some of you are familiar with the game that finally ended up, but this is the mode I went in first because Tony Kramer, the designer, and I decided let's have sharks playing pool. Let's have them in suits. And then I came up with the idea of how about a cast of characters that we could give voice acting to. So I invented the characters of Hammerhead and Great Whitey and Tiger Shark, and then invented their scientific, biological, Latin terms for who they were. Just for fun. This is such a departure from the kind of macho, heroic artwork I'm more famous for. People wonder whether this is actually, you know, my artwork. Well, they went for something. The response to this from marketing was like, it's just too aggressive. Too aggressive? After F-14 Tomcat? Well, this is sometimes what you have to accept when you're a professional illustrator. So this is how the game turned out. All the aggression has been removed. It's very quiet. It's very sedate. It's got a big old pool table. And if I couldn't have dynamic action, then I was going to have sexy babes. So they serve no purpose whatsoever except eye candy in the game because pinball has a long history of good-looking women on those back glasses. So I went, all right. If I'm a guy in a bar drinking beer and I've got to try my hand at some pinball, what kind of women do I want on my pinball game? It's the 80s big hair. All right. This was not a challenge to work on, particularly other than the fact I had absolutely no reference to work from. I was told from reading the script that Arnold's face gets demolished gradually in the course of the climax of the movie. But I don't know what that looks like. I had a little thumbnail sketch from Jim Cameron that was sent to me showing various different stages of destruction of his face, but they didn't really have a lot of information, so I guessed. And this was my first sketch I did for approval that shows absolutely nothing from Terminator 2 in there, but they liked the artwork, and it was sent out there for approval by Arnold. Arnold loved it. He said, this looks fantastic. He'd like to actually own the painting someday. But he had one caveat. That was, Doug, I need to see myself somewhere in the artwork on the back glass wearing the sunglasses. Well, you tell me where I'm going to put sunglasses on that. He had seen this. But he also knew that his character was defined by the leather outfit and the sunglasses and the cool that his character had in that movie. So he wasn't wrong. They hadn't even made the movie posters yet, but he knew what his signature look was going to be. So that's why he asked me that. So I looked at that and I went, what am I going to do with that? Where am I going to put him? A little tiny head in a corner wearing sunglasses, jumping out of a HK in the background. So feeling a little bit like Skynet itself, I went back into the painting, which was done. Like it took long enough to get the feedback. I had painted this completely and it was finished. The painting is hanging up over in the museum right now. It's on display. And I got my paint back out and I literally painted another Arnold's portrait right on top of that Terminator head on the right, painting the flesh on top of the metal just like Skynet. No one told me what his sunglasses were going to look like. No one showed me any pictures, so I went, okay, I'll make up a pair. And it turns out that I wasn't like so far off that anybody actually even noticed. So that was a great challenge for an artist to get that put together. And it's not nearly as nifty of a composition as this, but it still became an iconic image associated with the game and the film. This is an example of the opposite process of development. You know, when I was working at Ad Posters in 1980, they had a Joe Jews design come in, and I could do anything I wanted on it. And at that point in time in my life, I had started out as an illustrator heavily influenced by a magnificently popular illustrator from the 1970s named Frank Frazetta. Frazetta was responsible for doing the covers of the Conan novels, and he had done a number of motion picture posters, and his work was just hugely popular. Another artist inspired by Frazetta was Paul Ferris over at Bally, which was his inspiration for doing Lost World and Paragon. And it was one of the reasons I was hired in the first place by Advertising Posters, is they wanted an artist to compete with Paul Ferris. They were doing four-color process printing over there at Lank Smith. Advertising Posters wasn't doing four-color process printing. Advertising Posters was losing business to Lank Smith, losing business to Paul Ferris's art department. My portfolio from school had this Frazetta imitator kind of look to it. They hired me. Well, my first breakaway from that whole Frazetta trend was this piece I did, which was inspired by a European adult comic book called Metal Hurlant. I don't know if anybody here remembers that. It went on to become a magazine in the U.S. called Heavy Metal magazine in the late 1970s and early 80s. It featured a lot of French artists. In fact, some of the stories were still published in French. One of those artists was an artist named Kaza, who did a fantastic cover piece for Heavy Metal. That was my inspiration. He did a naked lady flying through some purple goop. So I did a naked lady flying through green goop. As if it was the, you know, quicksilver, like you find in a thermometer. And it was another one of my opportunities to get away with doing naked women in a fashion that was tasteful enough to actually get made and not offend anybody. So this literally became the backlash. Just like that. No creative process. When you left me alone at Posters and it was all my idea, I could just bang it out the first time and it saved a lot of time and effort, and also allowed my imagination to play like I could on Stern Games. When pinball became license-dominated, it became much less imaginative, kind of like movie posters today that are all done by photography, manipulated in Photoshop, as opposed to having an artist paint something for posters. All right. As part of the development process for how you arrive at the artwork for pinball games, when I was going to do my favorite game with Brian Eddy, one of my favorite designers, Attack from Mars, we had a discussion about, okay, we wanted to do a 1950s classic sci-fi kind of theme, but we wanted to give it a 90s updated look. So I studied 50s movies. So I was inspired by the mutant Metal Lunas from This Island Earth. Got any sci-fi geeks in the room here? Yeah, okay. Big brain heads, big buggy eyes like this, but very clumsy, moving, stupid, skinny guys because it's a guy in a suit. So I decided a 90s version of a Martian from the 50s. Okay, he's got to be buff. He's got to be biomechanical. He's got to have metal tubing underneath the skin. So I opened up his flesh and showed metal parts underneath. Gave him that whole big brain head look. We knew that we were going to make fun of these characters, so I gave him a huge expressive mouth, along with, what the hell, four arms. And I used my knowledge of anatomy to try to design, saying, what does it look like to have four arms? How do they work? Well, you need two sets of pecs and two sets of lats to make that work. So to come up with this look, I went out to the art store and bought some sculpting material, and I never sculpted anything before in my life, and I built a little mannequin and with wire on the inside, and I just sat in my office at Williams and just dreamed him up to be my model for the game, because I wanted to have dramatic light on this. I wanted to have an explosion in the background lighting up these characters dramatically, and I didn't want to just invent that out of my head. So there's my model. He was the guy for all the Martians from the backlash aliens, and he's got wire underneath so I could repose him into different positions and take these photographs. There they are. It was a big help. The woman in this picture, I can't remember her name right now, but she was a nicely slender young lady who worked in the front office at Williams, and I asked her if she'd like to model for me, and she agreed. You save money that way. And we went to a costume shop in Chicago, and I found a Marilyn Monroe costume, and I got her fitted out and brought her back, and we set up a photo shoot with some lights, and we tried to pose her in such a fashion that looked like you're being held in the arm of a giant four-armed, nine-foot-tall Martian. And we experimented with what that might look like, and I had a fan to blow on the dress to give it movement. Took a number of pictures, and that's how she came to be in the arms of my Martians. Boy, that was a fun project to work on. Another bit of trivia is, in addition to creating the look of the personality of the Martians for the game, I am also the voice personality of all the Martians in Attack from Mars. As I'm in the studio, and we, Brian and I had worked out scripting, and I spent an entire afternoon yelling my brains out into a microphone, being the character of all those silly, crazy, nutty Martians for the game. I had actually done a lot of voice acting for a number of pinball games at that point, because my voice digitized well, and I'm a hammy actor at heart anyway. I'm sorry?
Could you give us an example to do the voice now?
Not with the microphone here, no. Maybe later. Okay, moving way back in time, some of you are familiar with Stern's Big Game. I think we have one on the showroom floor over there. Well, I was the artist who was on that project first, and this was my drawing done literally way back in 1979. I'm just starting out. I'm just a kid out of school. Very much still under the Frazetta influence here. But this is me coming up with my first title, and I've got, okay, a babe who's just escaped from the Zulus, who's plunging into the jungle armed only with her little knife, who's about to be attacked by a lion and a crocodile, and the vultures are waiting to eat her, and the monkeys are looking on, and the giant snakes are coiling. To me, this is just how you made pinball fun. This is the kind of artwork I wanted to make. Jerry Simkus, the artist in the next cubicle to mine, took over the project. I don't remember why, because I got called off to do something else. I think it was the Spencer Gifts thing. She did a completely different layout for the back glass, with the big tiger head looking through the leaves. The game still features my side cabinet design art with the antelope with the long horns on there. Back in the 70s, cabinet side art was a real challenge because it was stenciled, hand-sprayed. In other words, they would literally simply make a great big plywood stencil and slam it up against the cabinet and go, ksh, and that's why it has the quality that it has of sometimes looking very shabby and edged. So trying to design artwork that would look good executed in that technique was quite a challenge. So that was my big game, one of those games that never got made. Now we're moving into the section that I wanted to talk about today, about all the ideas I came up with that never became games. Sitting in my office at Advertising Posters from 1979 to 1982, I didn't always have a project in front of me every single day. Sometimes you wrap up and you're waiting for the next one to come in. We were a silkscreen printing company as opposed to a manufacturer. So between games, I'm sitting in my office, and what I did, because I loved the possibility of doing my own game ideas, is I sat there and I just made up ideas to become pinball games. And I decorated the walls of my office, hoping that somebody from these manufacturers would come in and go, wow, cool, maybe we can make that into a game. That was my hope. This was one of those. Being fascinated with Art Deco and Art Nouveau and the whole quality of strong, persuasive graphic design, I think we had a cheetah back glass hanging up on the wall in the art department at Posters, which I thought was a beautiful graphic design. So I did one of my own, and I just picked sort of a dark, sinister theme to go with it of spiders and a spider lady, and I just did that. Never became a game. Here's that Frank Frazetta influence at its strongest. I wanted to do a game that looked like Frank had done it because of how popular his artwork was. So I just came up with this guy. We had Connie Mitchell over at Williams was doing Gorgar, and we had Paul Ferris over at Bally who was doing his thing. And I said, well, okay, this is a trend. Let me try my hand at it. So this is me executing just a pen and ink drawing of okay, a game that could be about this giant warrior dude whose mission is to rescue the girl. What did I know? Fun to do, never got made. Here's me still in my Frazetta mode, still with these dark themes from the late 1970s. This is my Panthers making another appearance after I had done Panthera and it was well received. I went, oh, so you like the big Black Panther look, do you? How about a guy who's hunting with a brace of them? You know, across a creepy landscape with castles in the background. This one never even got completely finished, but I did ink it to that point. Never got made. And here's an anomaly. Our salesman at Advertising Posters had made a contact with Spencer Gifts, that strange novelty catalog, which I think is still in existence, and convinced them that pinball backlash art was so popular that people would actually like to hang some up in their homes and own it. So we got the assignment to do two backlash pseudo pinball games at half size for games that simply didn't exist but looked as if they should have existed for Spencer Gifts, and they picked me as the artist to come up with them. I did two, Sorcery and Vixen. Vixen wasn't anywhere near as good. I don't have one, but I still have my Sorcery, and that's part of the museum show over in Alameda right now. And this is a little thing about this big, and it's just an invented pinball theme, just out of my head, once again trying to be as Frazetta as I could possibly look. Anybody here think I did it? Thank you. Mission accomplished. Once again, trying to do in line art, make something look like a painting, is about that laborious, stippled technique of all the colors. They took a very long time and took enormous amounts of concentration to execute like that. All right. I think there's a split second out there on the display floor. Once again, I did the first split second. This is my artwork, my drawing of my trapeze artists in mid-flight using split-second timing to execute what they were doing. Anyone might remember that in 1980, in that era, one of the main features in a lot of pinball games was things that timed down. Something that you wanted to achieve in a goal would be on for a while and then and go away. So that was big in pinball. So I had a lot of time to come up with ideas about time in terms of concept. This one actually got made, but once again, I didn't get to execute it. Jerry Simkus did. She did her version of my athletes in their same poses, used my title, and did a vastly more simplified background to do that game. I ended up doing the cabinet side art and some parts of the playfield, I believe. Back in those days, artists shared in pinball. So there's me coming up with, okay, a theme about things that time down. How do you convey that to someone walking by a pinball machine? This has got one of those time down themes. They've got enormous rewards if you're a good shooter and you can hit it before it times out. So I put my babes inside my giant hourglasses with pinballs flying out of the background and swirly designs, and I thought that would have been a cool game. Never got made. Once again, how do I make the concept of fighting time heroic? Because that's one of the consistent themes of my illustration and why I was such a popular choice to work with Steve Ritchie as a designer, is because of the idea of games that made you feel like a hero when you played them, that celebrated you, that teased you and taunted you and provoked you until you stood up and you beat that game, and then it went, oh, I give up, I submit, you beat me. I like that aspect about pinball, treating you with that quality of emotion. So here's a couple of my fantasy heroes trying to stop a giant locomotive with a clock face on there, peeling the hands right off the clock, because he's a time fighter, which is what you would be if you were playing the game. Never got made. This one almost got made. I think Meltdown actually got made, but not with this artwork. it turned into a game with a different title. But this isn't my first attempt at an acrylic painting, trying to use traditional line art bright colors, even though I was doing a painting. And the role of this guy is that you, as the player, are an operator at a nuclear power plant. And on one hand, you're being asked for more power, and on the other hand, you've got a coolant alert. So my concept for this game is that you had to keep hitting targets and keep hitting features and play like crazy to keep the coolant flowing throughout the entire pinball game, because it was getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and the lights could go up, 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 right up until the game melted down. And the whole thing would just go black, and your balls would drain. And they came to me and says, Doug, you know what we think of an idea about you turning the game off on a player in mid-ball? Not going to fly. But that was my idea for Meltdown. And this is one of my more extreme concepts, which was like, your job, this is before the movie Predator was ever dreamed up. This is 1980, well before that, which was your job as the player was to be dropped off on a primitive planet populated by dinosaurs, and you've got your K-2000 flesh ripper weapons, and you are hunting big game. Is that's the whole idea here. You've got a force field you can put over yourself, which was that force field that would take place in the game that would give you your ball back that would time down, and you are this manic-crazed hunter fighting Tyrannosaurus Rexes. Never got made. Here's a concept I came up with a dual glass. In other words, printed on one glass and then another glass also mounted right on top of it in the game. So Metamorph was going to be about the transition between having the metal peel right off a beautiful woman in transition. And so this is my idea for what it would look like with both glasses together. And what it looked like underneath looked like that. So I wanted to be a tease. I wanted people who saw the game to walk up to it and like put their heads real close next to the glass to see, like, peek underneath that metal and just be provocative and attractive in that way. I think that's it. My timing has been good today. Can I answer any questions about the process of all the games I dreamed up that didn't get made, or the development process about the games that I did? Mike?
Well, you talked to me a little bit about this before, but could you talk a little bit about the stippling process and how that fit into the screening process?
Okay, classic silkscreen that you know and love, which includes mirror on glass, the old 40s, 50s, and 60s games, and into the 70s. Silkscreen is one color at a time hitting. One of the reasons for going to four-color process is because there's only four screens hitting. CMYK, cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. Before that, it was called out colors, as many as 12, 13, 14, or more. Each one of those hits is more expense to go down for a particular color. I inherited this task from the guy who trained me, or who introduced me to it, was Gordon Morrison, who was doing silkscreen line art. He'd handed off a color sketch to a cutter who'd put it over a light table and literally cut those colors into the shapes they would go down on a silkscreen hit. I wanted to control my artwork more than that, so I insisted on cutting my own color separations for silkscreen, and then I realized it all looks so flat. How can I model it? How can I create light on form? How can I make it have three-dimensionality in form in my figurative artwork? The only way to achieve it was hand stippling, literally in that Virgil Finlay style that you appreciate so much. And it took a lot of time and effort and execution to pull off, particularly in Barracora, which was mind-bogglingly hard. So that's where that... Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your exhibit at the Civic Pinball Museum?
I don't know what to say about it. It covers my entire career from the first game I did to the last game I did. I did in my career, I worked on about 30 pins and about 80 arcade video games I worked on. I did the entire package for about 18 pinball games, where it's all me and not other artists contributing to it. Of those 18 games, I believe that 15 or 16 of my back glasses, the original paintings or the line art printed glass, are on display at the museum, along with a write-up of the creative process, who the influences on me were at the time, and a little story about the background of what I had to contend with at the time when I made it. I hope that you enjoy reading it, and I hope you enjoy the show.
Earlier you showed that there's a lot of iterations getting to the final artwork.
Yes.
And how is that determined, like how much time you were going to spend on something? Did you basically have to stay up to like 3 in the morning until you got it done? Was it
often.
They, I'm sure they didn't plan on 11 iterations in
the... Well, the creative process for pinball at the time when we were working at Williams and at Bally too is you start out with the back glass concept because that's where you're establishing your theme. You come up with a title, you come up with a theme, you come up with an idea that you establish there, and then you can flesh that out across the rest of the playfield, across the plastics, the bottom arch cabinet, the whole package comes together, but you sort of begin with the back glass design of what it's going to be. So that's where the critical moment creatively, but it's also the first thing you do in the project. Well, as you move forward, the more time you spend on the back glass, the less time you get to do everything else. There's an end date on the calendar when that thing's all done, and it's got to be all done. So sometimes there's more time up front, sometimes less time. Does that answer your question? To do iterations of a big license like Indiana Jones, I've got to do the time to get it approved if it's a license. In other words, if it's not just my company signing off on my illustration, but I've got motion picture production companies, marketing companies, movie directors, or movie stars who all have to sign off on that, you've got to make them all happy.
Well, I'm just wondering how the contract's set up on this, because, like, ad posters got to make money on this, right?
Well, I wasn't doing that for ad posters.
Well, but, or whoever you're working for, even for yourself, you got to make money on this thing. But, you know, maybe they didn't plan on doing 11 iterations.
Well, I simply had to do as many iterations as it took to get the job done. If I can hit it in one, yay! If I don't hit it in one, it takes more time. Please.
When you were doing the stippling, didn't you have to work backwards? Literally the outside, the first color that you're going to see in the layering, didn't you have to work on that first and work your way backwards?
Excellent question. I would start out with a tight pencil drawing like I did for Barracora as my guide. Then I would do the black first, which is going to be the first color hit down on the back of that glass, and all the other colors are going to hit behind it like this. So with my black as my key line guide, all the other colors I would hand stipple on top of the black, even knowing they're going to go behind. It took a lot of imagination to figure out, particularly like the yellow and orange screens that are very prominent on that piece, is like... It's dense. I mean, it's tens of thousands of dots, each one put down by hand to get that particular look, but nothing else would create that look.
I'm sure that you had some per inch, probably in the, 300 or 400 or 500 dots in a little square inch or more than that.
I wasn't thinking about square inches when I was doing the drawing. I mean, they're big. Like this, and you use pin registers, and you get everything in registration with all the screens that you do, and you just do one, and then you do the next, and you do the next, and you have no idea actually what it will look like until it's printed.
But did you have the department burn each layer for you as a plaque?
Oh, they're photographed, and then from the photography films, you make a silk screen.
And totally off a Pantone color system, or did you use your own?
We didn't have Pantone at Ad Posters. We had their in-house colors. It was extremely limited. Pantone came along later, after I had done Barracora. I mean, the whole engineering and technology of printing is a part of my whole career, but I don't have time to cover it. One more question I've got. Yes, in the back.
I was just kind of wondering, with your Spencer Gift backplate, the numbers, the scores on there, did you have anything special to decide what your number, you put the numbers up there, or did someone else?
I just made them up. Yep. They have no hidden meaning, sorry. Nothing esoteric to pass on to your friends. Okay.
You said Attack from Mars was inspired by stuff from the 50s. Was it licensed from any specific movie?
No, that's a whole story about how the movie Mars Attacks came to us in the middle of our project and says, hey, this is our license, you can't have it. And we said, we developed this, we had no idea you're making a movie. Mars Attacks is based on a collectible card series from the 1960s. We just came up with our own idea. It was just serendipity that their movie and our game were in simultaneous development. So I'm the one who wrote up a 3-page legal document describing in detail how our license and our project differed from theirs. They have little 3-foot-tall Martians in spacesuits and plastic helmets that are little mean bastards with their ray guns, and I had 9-foot-tall Martians with forearms. I'm afraid my time for today is over. I'd like to thank you all for coming. I hope everyone has a chance to come see my show at the museum. I believe that these will help you get into the show. And enjoy the rest of the weekend. Thank you.